And in the larger catechism here, we're now going to question, well, it's question 107, but it's really starting to focus on the second commandment. And the purpose of this, let me just restate this again, the purpose of doing this is to not just think about the moral law as we look at what the Puritans thought was required and forbidden in these commandments, but to think about specifically, can you find ceremonial and or civil law in the nine that we're going to go through? We already looked last time and we saw, yep, we see a little bit of both coming to the surface in the first commandment. So let's look at the second commandment and see what comes up. Question is, what is the second commandment? The second commandment is, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, that's in the earth beneath, that's in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am the jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children of the third and fourth generation, those who hate me, showing mercy to thousands of those that love me and keep my commandments. What are the duties required in the second commandment? The duties required in the second commandment are the receiving, observing, and keeping pure and entire all religious worship and ordinances as God has instituted in his word, particularly prayer and thanksgiving in the name of Christ, the reading, preaching, and hearing of the word, the administration and receiving of the sacraments, church government and discipline, the ministry and maintenance thereof, religious fasting, swearing by the name of God, vowing unto him, also disproving, detesting, opposing of all false worship, and according to each one's place and calling, removing it, and all monuments of idolatry. So we'll stop there. The question is, well, there's a couple of questions. First of all, you can also answer the question, what do you think about their answer? Do you think that they've gone too far? Do you think that they haven't said enough? Do you like what they wrote? Do you think these are fair duties required? And then, also, do you see any kind of ceremonial law here and any kind of civil law here? What do you think? This one shouldn't be too tough. Yeah, over.
Like Moses, think that you should not have any images of animals or people or whatever, as I understand it. And the temple in Jerusalem, almond trees,
all kinds of stuff, yeah.
So we know it is an absolute law as far as making an image for just to look at.
Right. Can you think of how that might relate to ceremonial or civil law?
That's what I'm trying to bring it back to ceremonial law.
Uh huh.
So to bow down to that image, like the serpent on the
Pole, yeah.
What do you call it?
Nehashtun, I think. Yep.
Right. That they begin to worship that thing, so they're told to get rid of it.
Yeah, Hezekiah destroyed it because it had become a source of worship. Yep.
I think about one of the sermons you've given a long time ago when Moses came down from the mountain. And the people were worshiping God, but they had the image. And it's not that they were worshiping false gods. They made the cow part of their
worship of him.
Yeah.
Yep.
They added that to the mix.
Yeah. So I'm trying to say what it says on that. It's talking about like images of spiritual things.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, the temple had pomegranates, everything else is showing the garden in a temple that temple imagery was bad.
Right.
So why for the most part Puritans tend not to have like any at all?
Go watch the newer version of the Luther movie and you'll see why.
Okay.
Because they were overreacting.
They were overreacting.
Yeah.
Kind of like how Rome does now.
Yeah.
That too.
Yeah. Luther, there's a comment in the movie where Luther's like, this is not what I was trying to do. completely overthrow absolutely everything that everybody has ever done. So, you know, humanity kind of does the pendulum thing. We just have this tendency to do that. So.
I know, you know, I'm getting on the Orthodox churches tend to have it, you know, that same argument. Yeah, you know, the temple had, you know, the kind of stuff. But yeah, not, you know, you're not to make images of like Christ and all that. And then it's for cat. Well, no, they got that too, but there are icons like that. And then it's for a cat. Reasons or?
Yeah, and there's obviously Reformed because of Calvin are like images of teachers of lies. That's what Habakkuk says. So, I mean, that's a different discussion, should we or shouldn't we? The point is, you can easily see here that things that are required are keeping pure the religious worship of God. So what is that? How is that not ceremonial law? It's literally what it is, right? Yeah.
So did Luther, like, I think the Lutherans, when I've heard them talk, the Catholics ignore the second and break the tenth in half.
Right.
So the Lutherans seem to kind of maybe consider the first two as one and then break the tenth.
Right.
And then sort of they
right.
don't really strongly. What did Luther think about that?
I think he kept the Roman division. I think he did. Which is what allows them to have the images and stuff that they have. But I'm not 100% sure. Not a Lutheran scholar. Do you see any civil law here? Because I think there is. How about this language? Church government and discipline. It said what's required in the second commandment is keeping pure all church government and discipline. What would church government be if not civil law? Now, it's civil law applied in the context of the church. So it's not the state in that case. But nevertheless, government, by definition, would be civil, wouldn't it? Okay, so do you see my point of how this one is bleeding over into those categories? Now, for me, the way I've arranged them, just in my mind, the simplistic way of thinking, the first four are primarily about the moral law applied to religious ceremony. The second six are primarily the moral law applied to civil life. Because one deals with God, ceremony, one deals with neighbor, civil. But yet we're seeing that even here there's a bleed over with civil. And the question is, are we going to see the same things going on bleed over the other direction with the later ones? Let's go to what is forbidden in the second commandment. The sins forbidden in the second commandment are all devising, counseling, commanding, using, and anywise approving any religious worship not instituted by God himself, the making of any representation of God, of all or any of the three persons, either inwardly in our mind or outwardly in any kind of image or likeness or any creature whatsoever, all worshiping of it, or God in it or by it, the making of any representation of feigned deities, all worship of them, the service belonging to them, all superstitious devices corrupting the worship of God, adding to it, taking from it, whether invented or taking up for ourselves, received by tradition from others, though under the title of antiquity, custom, devotion, good intent, or any other pretense whatsoever, simony, sacrilege, all neglect, contempt, hindering, opposing worship and ordinances which God has appointed. I was hoping nobody would ask me that. I think it has to do with like indulgences, stuff like that, money.
The buying or selling of ecclesiastical privileges, for example, pardons or benefits.
Yeah, so I think simony would include indulgences to some degree. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not going to explicate what they're doing here other than just to say that in Reformed theology, the second commandment, we do what we do because God has commanded us to do it. In what? In worship. So this is forbidding things that men do in worship that they've added to worship. But the point is, this is all ceremonial. I mean, it's just so much about ceremonial law. So if you see a commandment in Leviticus about sorcery, witchcraft, that kind of stuff, would be in the context of ceremonial life, but it would fall under the category of something like this, even though this is a moral law. See what I'm saying? Let's keep going. What are the reasons annexed to the second commandment? The more to enforce it. The reasons annexed to the second commandment contained in these words, "For I, the Lord, your God, am a jealous God, visiting iniquity on the fathers to the children of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me and showing mercy to thousands of those that love me and keep my commandments," are besides God's sovereignty over us and propriety in us, his fervent zeal for his own worship, his revengeful indignation against all false worship, as being spiritual whoredom, accounting the breakers of this commandment such as hate him and threatening to punish them to diverse generations and esteeming the observance of it as love him and keep his commandments and promising mercy to them to many generations. So this is a moral law because it deals with hate and love of God. But it's particularly a ceremonial law because it deals with worship. The context of ceremony, how we approach God, how we think about, how we act in worship towards him. Okay? Yeah, Carl?
Can you address just briefly how annexation figures into this? When we use the term annex to the second commandment?
So the annex is just, it's a giving a reason for the commandment. There's only a couple of them that give a reason. Most of them just say, do not do this. This one says, don't do this because I am a jealous God and I will visit iniquity. So that's the annex. It's an addition to the commandment. And that annexation, I think, really shows the moral quality of the commandment. Because it's dealing with what God does because it's right and wrong. You see? Well, let's go to the third commandment. The third commandment is, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes his name in vain. You can see there's an annex to this one as well. So what is required in the third commandment? The third commandment requires the name, that the name of God is titles, attributes, ordinances, the word, sacraments, prayer, oaths, vows, lots, his works, whatever else there is whereby he makes himself known, be holy, holily, and reverently used in thought, meditation, word, and writing by a holy profession and answerable conversation to the glory of God in the goods of ourselves and others. See any ceremonial here? You see a lot of ceremonial here. What is ceremony? How about prayers, oaths, vows, sacraments? Ordinances, attributing to God his titles, that would be praise, wouldn't it? Reverently, holily used. Now this is interesting because you keep going. Where do we do this duty? In thought, meditation, word, and writing. In other words, not just in church, but everywhere. That right there, it seems to me, bleeds over a little bit into civil life. Because if you're to obey this commandment and keep God's name holy when you are going to drop your kids off to school and it's snowing outside and the guy in front of you starts skidding and you get pretty mad about it, that's not, you're not in worship service. It's a ceremonial duty that you have to God, right? But you're doing it in your civil life, your regular life. So that would include any place in our civil life.
I think about the fact that we are to be being a light among the world, to the darkness, to people around us.
Mm-hmm.
I think that ties into the second commandment as well.
Mm-hmm.
That we worship God rightfully, and we not lead others to worship false idols. In place of God, that we lead them to worship God truthfully.
civil for us to do so in front of others to show them Christ.
Right. It's interesting. I think about a Vertical Limit. Have you guys seen that movie? 20-year-old movie about, it's a super hokey, about climbing K2, the second highest mountain in the world. One of the guys in the movie is a Muslim. You've probably seen this in other movies. It's super silly because they're at like 26,000 feet and all of a sudden he pulls out his carpet, gets down on his knees, and starts praying to Allah, right? Like, who's going to bring a carpet up 26,000 feet when you're trying to save somebody? But the point is, here was a guy in his civil life. He's going to rescue somebody on a mountain who all of a sudden stops, pulls out his blanket, and kneels down and prays. This kind of struck me, that it's that image of how our worship is supposed to go throughout our lives. That's just an image of it. Not that we're supposed to do that. But you can think of Daniel doing that very same thing, right? Opening his window like he had done every day. I'm not going to close my window. And he got in trouble for it in the civil realm, not in the ceremonial realm. Okay?
That's why that's one of the very reasons the world hates us, because they see us, you know.
Exactly. Let's go to the sins forbidden in the third commandment. These are not using God's name as is required. The abuse of it in an ignorant, vain, irreverent, profane, superstitious, or wicked mentioning, or otherwise using his titles, attributes, ordinances, works by blasphemy. Here's one. Perjury. Where do you do perjury?
Court.
Not in worship. Although we could do perjury in our worship service because we take an oath every week. But technically, you think of it in court. All sinful cursings, oaths, vows, and lots. Where was Jephthah when he said, "Hey, the next thing that comes out of my house, I'm going to kill it"? Was he in church?
He's at battle.
Yeah, he'd just come back from a battle. So that would be civil, wouldn't it? Let's see. Of things unlawful, murmuring and quarreling at, curious prying into, misapplying God's decrees and providences, misinterpreting, misapplying, or anyway perverting the word or any part of it to profane jests, curious or unprofitable questions, vain janglings, or the maintaining of false doctrines, abusing it, the creatures, anything contained under the name of God, to charms, sinful lusts, practices of maligning, scorning, reviling, or anywise opposing God's truth, grace, and ways, making profession of religion in hypocrisy, for the sinister ends, being ashamed of it, to shame it by the uncomfortable and wise, unfruitful, offensive walking or backsliding from it. To me, this is an interesting one because this is almost wholly civil life, isn't it? You know, we bear the name of Christ upon our very person. Why? Because what are we called? Christians. That is what we are. And so if our lives are not behaving properly in any of the ten, we are taking God's name in vain. And so all of a sudden, boy, the third commandment, it's applying in ceremonial and civil places everywhere we go. Isn't that crazy? Now, just to stop, pause, go forward for what we'll look at in the future, and then we'll come back to this and do it again, because I just want you to get this wrapped into your head. One of my purposes, and we're going to do this with Leviticus 19 especially, is to look at all these crazy laws that are just like, they just seem so randomly placed. What does this have to do with anything? And if I can get you to see that the moral law is the ten, and yet the moral law applies ceremonially and civilly, all of a sudden, you cannot go, "Well, that's just some ceremonial law that doesn't have any moral purpose to it." You see? That's what I want you to be thinking. Now, it may not apply today the same way it did then as a ceremonial law, but that's because of the things Jesus did. It's not because all of a sudden morality has changed. That's not the case. It's just that the circumstances have changed because the perfect law keeper came.
I'm thinking about Peter in Acts. Yeah. With Cornelius.
Yeah.
And
yep.
He ends up having that vision, and he is perplexed by it because he doesn't understand the meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And when he gets to his house, he understands what it was talking about and what's the ceremonial to the civil, and he sees the difference in how it applies.
It's great thought, Louise. I was actually reading that today too, because I'm trying to catch up. And I woke up way early, so I'm like, all right, I'll catch up. And so I came across that, and it just struck me that there's a saying that comes in the Gospels earlier that Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and he talks about the things that come out of a man is what makes him unclean, not what comes in. And then there's a little parenthesis, and it says, by saying this, Jesus made all food clean. And yet we don't really get the application of that until Acts 10, when Peter has a dream. But yet, what that's saying is that Jesus is the one who had already done this. He had changed the ceremonial because he is the perfect perfect moral law keeper. And therefore, its ceremonial use to teach us about who God is has ceased to function the way that it did in those days. So that's a great, great connection there you made. All right, the reasons annexed to the third commandment. The reasons annexed are, for the Lord your God will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain, because he is the Lord and our God. Therefore, his name is not to be profaned or any way abused, especially because he will be so far from acquitting and sparing the transgressors of the commandment that he will not suffer them to escape his righteous judgment, albeit many such escape censure and punishments of men. This, I'm really being struck by the way the annexed things focus your mind on the morality of it. This is the moral law of God, and it is wrong to take his name in vain, period. And because it's wrong, he will not hold you guiltless. That's what it says. So the reasons are rooting what we just saw in ceremonial civil life in morality that's objective and always true. Never changes. Isn't that interesting?
Is it a stretch then to say that the morality is rooting itself in the essence of God? Because he never changes.
That's great. Great point. So something is not right or wrong just willy-nilly or just randomly. And then in some other possible world, all of a sudden it's okay. Whereas in this world, it's not okay. No. The reason things are right or wrong is because God never changes. And right or wrong is defined by who he is. That's a fantastic point, Carl. And we all need to hear that. It's great. Truth, right and wrong. So let's get out of ceremony and civil life. Just right and wrong. Bare right and wrong. Objective morality. It's always wrong everywhere to torture little babies for fun is the one that C.S. Lewis used to use a lot. There's never a possible world where this is okay. It's not that the stars just sort of fated the universe to say that, okay, in this world it's wrong to do that, but in this one it's okay. That's what postmodernism is trying to convince you is actually the case. They're trying to say cultures create objective morality. That's not true. God is the reason objective morality exists because he does not change. He's the definition of right and wrong, truth and goodness. And that expresses itself in, you know, especially the Ten Commandments, as we focus on who God is and what's therefore right and wrong to do with relation to him and who he's made image bearers to be, what's right and wrong in relation to one another. Those don't change just because you have a different feeling about it. Okay?
What do you think about publicly mentioning that to someone in your daily life?
Feel free. People need to hear it. The church needs to be proclaiming it, and Christians need to tell people when they're at work or when they're in with their neighbors, you know, talking about cooking or whatever, and something like this comes up, Christians need to stand up and say, this is not right. This is not the way that right and wrong works. Everybody also knows this, by the way, deep down. Because they all know it's always wrong for you to do something terrible to them. It might be okay for you to do something terrible to somebody that's not them. But try it. Next time they say, well, that's not the way my morality works, then hit them over the head with a 2x4 and see the way that they respond to that. It's always wrong everywhere to hit me in the head with a 2x4.
Well, it seems like the morality is being pushed around there in a matter of convenience. It's always about
that. Sure. It's a matter of they're breaking the law already and they want to justify it. That's what it is.
And,
go ahead.
Whereas we need to move around to eventually is when Christ said, he who is ashamed of me, I will be ashamed of him before my Father.
Yeah, who confesses me, I will confess him, and he doesn't confess me, I won't confess him.
So we are ashamed of God to mention him in that context. How does that impact our standing?
We saw this very thing either in the, I think it was in the one right prior to this, or it might have just been here, I don't even remember, but just being ashamed of the name of Christ. Yeah, so this is probably what you were thinking of when we read that. So, over here.
Yeah, I was just going to comment that many years ago I used to go to Coco's for breakfast, and there was an old man and a younger man that used to sit right next to me every day, and the old man could not say a sentence without cursing God. And one day I had enough, and I just went over and I said, "May I sit down for a minute?" And and I started explaining exactly this to that man. And the next week,
but what did you say to him?
I said, "You are taking the name of the Lord in vain, and it's absolutely forbidden to do that." And I said, "It's offensive to me as a person, and to me as a Christian, and to God." And I said, "I think you ought to reconsider what you do." Well, the next week, the young man came over to me, and he said, "Thank you for saying that, because my dad has needed to hear that for 30 years. And I never heard the old man curse again."
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know if this is a stretch, but I meet with some guy. Cruise, now, Campus Crusade to Christ, now Cruise. And in order to, I've had it explained to me by one of the guys, to not be offensive to Muslims, they don't call themselves Christians, call themselves Christ followers. I'm wondering, how does that fit in here? We change from a Christian to, no, I'm not a Christian, I'm really just a Christ follower.
Well, first of all, I'm like, how is that not offensive to a Muslim? But yeah, no, it's fitting exactly the point. It's fitting the point. Like, you're embarrassed about it to the point that I can't offend this person. Because, boy, if they got offended the fact that I'm actually a Christian, then they would never listen to my message as a Christian. Like, doesn't even make sense.
Mm-hmm. Believing their own thing. And if having a conversation with you almost kind of makes you timid because they are so strong. The next day, I was like, that verse, "He did not give us the spirit of timidity, but one of power and love." It's the power. He's given us power to speak against that. So the next time getting to speak with her, this is right because it's following the moral law of God. You're fearing God, not make up your own
feel-good
morality.
Yeah.
So I got a question just to balance some of these things out. I'm thinking of, if you call the Islamic leader a name, they'll kill you. And they will put you to death for blasphemy. We hear that happen.
Yep.
And so there's some rules of the kingdom here. I'm thinking of not to go further and rebuke a fool. Rebuke a scoffer. Rebuke a mocker. We announce who Christ is. He's the living
Son of God. He's God the Son. And he's the only way of life. I don't have to say your leader is a homosexual pervert. Because Christ said, speak evil of no man. And sometimes we get ourselves in trouble doing that. Instead of just stating forth the truth, we go one step and we get ourselves in hot water. But I'm just thinking like that. You got, whatever you guys think, my comment, there's these rules. And I got a lot of insult, unnecessary, where I was just obeying. I was not obeying Christ, and now I've kind of grown wiser. You don't have to do that, that, or that. You don't have to make enemies, but you're going to make enemies telling people Christ is the only way to heaven. Like, Louise said, they're so strong, they can't stand that. They want to kill us. If they can get in government here, they'll kill us all. But there's rules, and I'm thinking that way. I'm thinking that way. There's certain boundaries. Don't go here, because I don't end up in jail or beat up for something stupid I did that Christ said, don't do that. But we will hold fast to Christ. We will say he's the only way. And the Trinity is the only God. And he's the only way. You're going to miss it. We can plead with him tenderly and mercifully. But I've got in trouble going beyond that. Just want to say that.
All right, let's keep going here to the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment is remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, your son or your daughter, manservant, maidservant, cattle, stranger that's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath and hallowed it. So what's required in the fourth commandment? The fourth commandment requires of all men the sanctifying and keeping holy of such set times as he has appointed in his word, expressly one whole day in seven, which was the seventh from the beginning of the world to the resurrection of Christ, and the first day of the week ever since. And so to continue to the end of the world, which Christian Sabbath and in the New Testament called the Lord's Day. How is the Sabbath to be sanctified? Sabbath day is to be sanctified by a holy resting all the day, not only from such works as are at all times sinful, but even from such worldly employments and recreations as are on other days lawful, to make it our delight and spend the whole time in public and private exercise of God's worship. To that end, we are to prepare our hearts with such foresight, diligence, and moderation to dispose with and seasonably dispatch our worldly business, and that we may be more free and fit for the duties of the day. And I'll stop there because there's a couple more things. Focus is on ceremony and civil, and then you can also comment on what you think about what they actually said. How do you see ceremonial in the, or do you, in the fourth commandment about the Sabbath day?
Well, you're in part to spend it in the assembly.
Okay.
In worship.
In worship.
Which is ceremonial in part.
So you're keeping the day holy. Necessarily that involves ceremony. And think about it in the context of a Jew back then. What does that mean that they have to go do? Like, that's the height of the ceremony of the week. Okay? Do you see this bleeding over into civil at all, if at all?
Closing down stores on Sunday,
that's interesting. So it actually does impact civil life. We can certainly at the very least say that it did impact civil life in the United States. It's another thing to say it should it have, but it did. There's no question about that. I think car dealerships, they're still like the only thing not allowed to be open, aren't they? Or are they even open now on Sunday?
Hobby Lobby.
Well, that's their own thing. Chick-fil-A, right? It's so funny, like because it's okay to do that the other 6 days, but as long as you don't do it on the Sabbath day, right?
Keep the Sabbath day holy. But Christ commanded us to be as I am, holy, which means all the time. So we should keep our focus not only on the Sabbath, but on all the other days of the week, because that's the other thing we're commanded to do.
Yeah, my opinion is that the Puritans have some legalism that comes through in the way that they are dealing with the Sabbath. And one of the reasons you can see that is for exactly what you just said. The focus is so much on the one day. What about the other six? Isn't this what kind of what Jesus is getting at? I mean, how many times does he do stuff deliberately on the Sabbath, on purpose? He goes in there, he picks grain and gets in trouble for it. He goes and he heals a guy and gets in trouble for it. Not only does he heal him, he spits on the ground, makes a mud ball, which the Jews had said that's forbidden on the Sabbath. And he didn't have to do that. But he does it just to mock them. What's he doing? He's doing ordinary things that he does ordinary days. He's actually showing you that there's a bleed over into the Sabbath, into civil life, isn't he? You're hungry? Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So I actually think that's exactly what Jesus is doing. Is he's showing the legalistic tendencies that we can have when it comes to something like this, and that ends up creating great hypocrisy because we're only like that one day of the week, and that's not okay. That's now all of a sudden, if you're only like that one day of the week, now you're taking the Lord's name in vain the other 6 days of the week. How's that any better than breaking the Sabbath?
That's a great point. What would the religious people, I don't care if they're Protestant or Catholic, do if you went into the church and they got all their trappings and or people are like to be silent before God, you know, which we are. We come before him. Imagine you coming in and you find the guy with a withered hand and said, you, hey, first thing you do, stand up. Stand up. Come forward. Is it good to do evil or good on the Sabbath? Christ just literally was in their face healing this man, and they're like, is he going to do good to this man? I mean, how hard-hearted are we? We miss it. This is religious worship.
Right.
What are you doing standing people up who are miserable? That's what I came for. I'm the Lord of the Sabbath. Have your freedom worshiping my Father and I. Get out of this religious mess.
How many of you, if you had an ox fall into a ditch on the Sabbath, wouldn't go and take it out?
Yeah. Go help somebody.
So that's his point, right? So, yeah, this is a great one for showing that while maybe our tendency is to think, okay, this one really is focusing us on religious ceremonial law. Actually, it does. And so like you just said, it certainly has ceremonial law definite implications, but it also has civil law implications for the rest of your life.
The law of compassion and love.
Uh-huh. God's kingdom. So hopefully what we're going to see is we got another 10 minutes to do this with the second tablet is to see, all right, we've seen civil law bleeding over here with the ceremonial, which is what the main focus is on. Is it going to work the other way? Are we going to see ceremonial law implications with civil, with our brothers? All right. So let's zoom past the Sabbath so just so that we can get on with this and just see some of this. These are not as long. Some of them anyway. What is the fifth commandment? The fifth commandment is honor your father and your mother that the days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. So now in my mind, at least the way that the Puritans have broken down the ten, we are now moving into the horizontal relationship. This is brother to brother. In this case, it's son to parents. But nevertheless, we're moving away specifically from God to individual to God. And now we're moving horizontally to brother. So what is meant by father and mother in the fifth commandment? By father and mother are meant not only natural parents, but all superiors in age and gifts, and especially as such by God's ordinance are over us in place of authority, whether family, church, or the state. Isn't that interesting? Now notice it doesn't say it's not your father and mother, but it's only these other things. It says, of course, it's your father and your mother. You owe first and foremost respect and honor to your father and your mother as your parents. But also the whole principle of the morality is that you owe it to anybody who's in authority over you in any relationship that you are in. What do you think of that? Uh-oh.
Sure would be a different world if everybody followed that.
Wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? Now you can see certainly that this is dealing with civil law, can't you? Family, church, commonwealth. But if church is in there, doesn't that also mean it has to deal with ceremonial law? So if the purpose of elders and deacons as officers of the church is to perpetuate what Jesus commanded for the church to do, and then the obligation is if you're under that authority as someone in the church, and we're all under authority in different spheres of our life, so, but this is just in this sphere, then what does that mean? It means that we've just gone right back into the first four commandments is what it means. Because the job of the officers is to help you not violate the first four commandments in worship. So, we've just seen it bleed over again. Now it's going the other direction.
I guess an example of it going in the other direction is the churches, which now come to your congregation and say, we will now appoint as elders or pastors, priests, people from homosexual, with active homosexual lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
and you will give them due proper respect.
That's
going to be a challenge to the congregation.
I think, you know, without going too far down this, but since we're looking at it, so we should talk about it a little. I think that there's a difference between honoring the office and honoring the individual. You're not to honor your father in every sense if he molested you since you were a little kid. But you can still honor the father in his office as father, right? That's possible. You can do that. I'm not saying it's easy, but it certainly is possible. And I think the same thing would hold true in any other place of authority over us. If your boss is like smuggling millions of dollars and then taking it for himself and everybody knows it, you can still honor him as boss and seek a way to get him removed from that position and go to jail.
Yeah. That's what I meant by there will be a challenge to those.
Yeah.
Trying to walk that line.
Yeah.
Especially if the people who are telling them morally what's right and wrong is the one standing before them in the wrong.
It's interesting that in this case, probably in any of these cases, you have somebody who is blatantly violating objective morality now standing either in a civil or ceremonial place of authority, and they, by the very act of what they're doing, are undermining the base of what you're supposed to be doing either in civil or ceremonial life.
Is that a matter
of they could be or may not be. I mean, it depends on what we're talking about, I suppose. But they are undermining. This is true for any of us in anything that we do. If we're not living our lives consistently at work and we're taking God's name in vain because of our actions, we're undermining objective morality to the world. We're supposed to be a light and we're being darkness. And so I think what happens is systemically over a course of a culture, enough of this will end up undoing that culture. It will cease to exist. And we're seeing that happen right now before our eyes, because objective morality has completely unraveled. And the reason why is because we got people into authority in the church and into the state and in our families, and we refused to call them out for right and wrong when there was a chance to actually do something about it.
A couple things that are very important. The family has a lot of interactions, especially when the teenagers get older and they begin to want to be out on their own, and there's that tension that grows. How much honor do these kids give their parents? Are they subjected, or
are they duty bound to subject themselves to discipline, like deny something, or do those children have an obligation just to merely hear them out?
So I think you're asking the question that's related to elders and deacons and managing their household well. I think it's at least around that question. And my understanding is that that's dealing with kids that are still in the house. So some kid is older and then they rebel. That's not on the parents at that point in time.
Well, I'm saying that you're the head of the household.
Yeah.
The kid says, sorry, Dad, I think I'm old enough. I don't need to listen to you anymore.
So prodigal son.
Well, I'm going to go out, buy a car and take it whenever I want. I'm deciding I'm not going to obey you.
Yeah.
At, you know, maybe 18 years of age.
Yeah.
That's where the rubber hits the road. How much honor do they owe you?
Well, they owe you. They owe you honor until you're dead.
Obedience?
Honor and obedience are different things. But they owe you honor, and if they're acting in the specific way you just said, they're not showing honor through the way through their actions. There's recourse you can have as a parent in that particular instance because they're 18. And okay, go live on your own because you're not going to live under my roof anymore. You could do that. Whereas if they were 15, you couldn't do that. Honoring disobedience? Well, I don't know. If the parent is telling the kid to do something immoral, right? That would be honoring disobedience. You could do that. This was not that instance, right? Yeah. By the way, the fifth commandment it's actually in the original context, its focus wasn't really on kids in a house as little kids honoring their parents. It was actually on adult children honoring their elderly parents by taking care of them when they're old and giving them a proper burial. That's actually what it was. So, yeah. And that side of honoring your parents is abysmal these days. What do we do with our old parents? Stick them in a home and never see them again. Let them deal with it.
Let me point out that proper burial should be after they're dead.
Sometimes you can't tell when they're dead.
There's also a twist to this that I've been thinking about is in the realm of the church. This is proof text to debunk a congregationally ruled church, because from what I've understood and seen in congregationally ruled churches, the elders and the deacons really don't have authority in the church at all.
Yeah, it's a democracy, yeah. And everybody's equal.
Mm-hmm. You will do what we say as a church, or you're gone, type of deal, rather than submitting to a God-ordained order of authority.
It's interesting, you know, you don't have this particular problem in Rome or the East, because they actually call their priest what? Father. Now, they have other issues with that, but that's not one of them. Rome has never had a problem with people not honoring the priest. But yeah, I mean, obviously there's lots of problems that can go the other direction, but that's not one of them.
I think that's precisely why some of our politicians are now saying we live in a democracy, or that's dangerous to democracy, because a republic implies that there is some authority in the form of people as opposed to all of us voting.
Yeah, by the way, we got to say this because.